Not all men can be easily persuaded to wear a sheath, madam.
Oh, is that the case?
The girls nod in agreement and burble amongst themselves.
Fuss, they say. Angry. Don't dare.
Mrs. Frost rubs her chin as if deep in thought.
So, perhaps I see how it might have been. I know what men can be like once they are thoroughly provoked. You asked the gentleman to protect himself, but he said, no, I don't care for that, or I'll have none of the expense. Perhaps you did not dare ask him at all, you being a little nothing of a girl, and he being a gentleman of some years and standing. Is that how it was? Do I come close?
At this, one of the very youngest girls lets out a small hiccup. All faces turn to her. Her eyes are large with guilt.
Sarah, is this what happened to you?
Mrs. Frost demands. The child nods meekly.
He did it all of a sudden, madam, she says. I did not have a moment to...
You are the one who has imperiled this entire establishment?
I...
Listen to me. Each and every one of you.
She claps her hands again, once for emphasis.
If a gentleman wishes to go without, you say no. And I shall always support you in this matter. You may depend on that. If he will not comply, you need simply pull the bell and the bullies will come and that man will be removed. A visitor who cannot keep to our rules is no longer welcome, whoever he is. Do you all understand?
They nod and murmur.
Very well, she smiles. We are all here to protect one another. You were brave and good to tell the truth, she says to young Sarah.
Those Cyprian comrades standing nearest to the afflicted girl gather about and touch her briefly here and there. Sarah herself smiles very faint. Mrs. Frost catches the eye of the footmen who hover just on the staircase and nods.
Take her to the attic.
They surge forth and seize the girl by each arm, which action is unnecessary since she is very tiny and gives every impression of going quietly. She gasps, though, and stumbles between them as they frog-march her out of the room.
That is 5 guineas docked from her, and a beating to add to my list of duties, says Mrs. Frost. She has put me to a deal of trouble.
She turns back to the remaining girls.
Our Sarah is going to the attic for her good and ours, she says. And there she will stay until she is recovered. And fortunate she is that she has not been immediately ejected. She spreads her filth about the place, and yet I shall pay for her physician and keep her fed and watered, even as she does nothing to earn her keep. When I add up the money she has already lost me, it far surpasses anything I could dock from her. You are fortunate, girls, she says. You are by no means disposable. I have trained you, and I mean to keep you. We are a family now. All right, back to your work. You have an hour until it is time to dress for the afternoon.
She sweeps away, stopping to inspect the letters that have come for her.
An invitation, she observes. I do not receive many of those.
Chapter 24. And so to King's Place, where Mrs. Chapel, comfortably bailed for some months, is summoned to be sentenced on charges of running a house of ill repute. The pack of little dogs greets the constable's arrival with clamorous excitement, but Mrs. Chapel is less pleased.
Oh, for the love of Christ!
She exclaims, caught as she is in her green-papered parlour, with a mound of kedgeree just placed before her, and having mere moments ago found the position in which her bandaged foot can be balanced on its stool with only a modicum of agony.
Is that today? I wish you had set a more convenient date. We're all but ready to quit the city. My girls need their sea air, same as anybody.
And these?
She gestures to the dogs who busy themselves about the visitors, sniffing and yapping and waving their tails high, their claws all a-clatter on the parquet.
Are in sore need of a good run.
I am sorry, Bet,
says the constable, Mr. Trevithick, who has had cause to visit her house both for business and pleasure, going back some 20 years.
But what's to be done? Today is the day.
I do not know why I cannot send a proxy, she says. You know how it will go. I have paid out more in bail than whatever trifle I shall be charged today. 'Tis easy money for you, that is all. Why do you not spend the time dealing with real criminals?
When we receive a report, we must...
I do not know when it was that your people began paying any attention to reports concerning me,
she sighs, and reaches for Mrs. Hancock's handsome invitation.
Now look, we have so many engagements, a party in 2 days' time that I'm loath to miss. Do you remember this girl of mine, Mrs. Neal, as was? Now her life took a peculiar turn. I am most anxious to know how she's made out. If this nonsense of yours holds me up, I shall be most vexed. A mermaid party. Now, what do you think that can be? Her husband has a mania for them. I wonder what sort of freakish beast they've acquired this time. It cannot be that mummified waif they touted about before, for I hear Prinny threw that on the fire.
These reports, ventures Mr. Trevithick, it was stuffed with sawdust all along, you know.
Muses Mrs. Chapel.
But then so is Mrs. Fitzherbert's head, and it has not put him off her.
Madam, the things that are being said of you...
Oh, you will never prove a thing,
she says, reading the invitation again with a smile of pride. Mr. Trevithick steps aside to draw her attention to the flagellation machine which sits in the corner awaiting its weekly polish.
That signifies nothing, she says. And the numerous women, and very likely several men, we shall find running about upstairs in a state of undress.
Hardly ever in the morning,
she says. You ought to have come after 6 on a Tuesday if you'd wanted a compelling argument for moral correction. There ain't a drawer in the house that hasn't a condom in it, he says.
Upstairs, his men can be heard marching from room to room, punctuated by cries of irritation from the disturbed girls.
No Bet, he says half-jestingly. I warn you, it may be serious this time. I do not believe you, she chuckles, turning back to her breakfast. I have friends who will never allow that to happen.
He shakes his head and is very truly sorry.
You must have angered somebody. Angered? Never. They're all faithful visitors.
She still chuckles, but her countenance assumes the colour and humidity of cold peas pottage.
But we've always had an agreement.
The wheel turns. That ugliness at Twelfth Night, when the girl of yours ran away, and you would give no compensation.
Well, why should I have? She was under their care when she went missing. If there were any justice in the world, 'twould have been them compensating me. She was one of my best,
she says with some regret.
Could truly have been something. An exotic of her kind does not appear more than once in a blue moon. Not that she would have been taken up by anybody so very important. Not that any aristocracy would pledge his troth to a lady of her complexion. But she was a valuable asset nonetheless, Mr. Trevithick.
Well, that says maybe. But it don't do to get on the wrong side of people of that sort,
Mrs. Chapel is shaking her head in wonder.
I cannot credit it, she says. 30 years I've been at this address. We are a beloved institution.
She turns in her chair as best she can without disturbing her foot.
What has become of this city?
Ah, it's not what it was.
He tuts and lights his pipe.
Have a bite to eat, Bat. You might as well.
Aloft, a shriek, a crash and a bellow, followed by sounds of pursuit. Young Kitty is shortly borne into the room, swiping and squirming in a manner perfectly commensurate with her feline name, by a warden whose wig has been knocked off and who sports on his brow a bleeding gash.
"She hit me!" he cries. "Brought a clothes rail down on my head, so she did! Kitty!"
The girl brings her lips back in a snarl.
"I'll not let them hurt you."
When she is set down, she darts to Mrs. Chapel's side and clings fiercely to her hand.
"There, there. You're a good girl."
Above, there are sounds of further struggle, thuds and scampering, and the curses of the men.
"Saints alive, they'll do somebody a mischief. Call them off. Call them off," she says to Mr. Trevithick. "Tell them I demand it."
She gives Kitty's shoulder an affectionate shake.
"They're bound to be upset. They love the seaside."
He ventures upstairs, and the furore first escalates, then abates. When he descends again with his men, they drive before them four of Mrs. Chapel's girls in various stages of sullen undress, their gowns ripped, their hair tousled, and their bosoms heaving with the exertion of their fight.
"That's a lot of them," says one of the officers with considerable pride. "Along with a gentleman wearing only a pair of stays. Ought we to bring him in?" "What are you about?"
asks Mrs. Chapel, jabbing her fork at the girls.
"Fighting so?" "Biting, screaming, throwing chairs," chips in Mr. Trevithick. "Oh, but they left off soon enough. 20 years ago, they would have torn a man limb from limb by now." "You're soft," she says to her girls. "When Lucy Fletcher cost the gentleman with a rolling pin," Mr. Trevithick recalls fondly, and Mrs. Chapel rocks in her seat, wheezing her appreciation.
"I shall never forget it. And the night the ladies of Mrs. Scott's set fire to the whole place rather than let it be taken."
She glances at the girls.
"Now that is a course of action I do not advise." "The quality's not what it was," agrees Mr. Trevithick. "The young ladies now got no spirit in them." "Well, that's the fault of the gentlemen. They demand good manners, refinement. How would I sustain a cohort of screaming hell bitches if nobody had ever paid me for them? Oh, 'tis a sorry time for whoring. Not like our youth. We'll not see those days again, but I've kept you long enough," says Mrs. Chapel. "I suppose you'll be wanting to do your job."
She offers her wrists, and Mr. Trevithick manacles them very gently before her, with so much slack as to curtail her movements, very little indeed.
"Not too tight. No. Not rubbing. Very comfortable. I'm much obliged to you. Come, girls, help me."
One of her white-clad mob stoops to lift her bad leg gently from its stool. Another comes to her chair to help her rise. Mr. Trevithick offers his arm, and Mrs. Chapel seizes it with both hands and hauls herself up, all the blood in her face so that her eyes fairly pop.
"Is he taking you away?"
asks Kitty, most afraid.
"Oh, do not take alarm. The gentleman is only doing his duty. And once justice is served, we should go unmolested by it for a good long time. Confound it, I hate to be in court. All the mob crowding in to look upon one, throwing their orange peels and making up their dreadful ditties. If I had aspired to entertain so, I should have taken to the boards. Well, if I am to be looked at, I shall need my rouge. Fetch it, Kitty.
Anything for your comfort?
Asks Mr. Trevithick.
It may be a long day. Aye, of course, my cushion too, Kitty, and my pills, and my book. There's a good girl.
She squeezes the child's hand with her little shackled claw.
I shall be out within the day. You may depend on it.
As Mr. Trevithick guides her out of the breakfast room, he says,
"'Tis a shame, Bat, that it's come to this. I hope you're not detained too long. Oh, I shall be out again in a twinkling, she says. And I am glad it was you who came for me. I've not seen you in a great long time. Tell me, how does Mrs. Trevithick?
I have been borne a great distance. This dull thud of nothing encloses me yet, but somewhere above the water is the burble and twitch of animal life. I am crushed here in this egg. I long to expand and to rush and to leap. Oh, I strain and I listen. And I am still. And I turn over the better to feel their voices and movements quiver upon my being. Out there, souls flicker. And I would call out to them, if they can hear me, come hither, come hither. Touch me again with your speaking. The hectic, crowded feeling of being, I would drink it all in, brimming with things that swell and make me flip over on myself, elation and jealousy and spasms of love. The sensation, I know, is the one from the sea when I jostled among and beside and through and about a chorus of knowings that were all my own. The drowned ones who slipped down through the water breathed out globes of grief and rage, which flew upward towards the air. We shivered at their passing. There is the thud of a heart that attracts me especially. A young one, I know this sort, all wandering like the dark-eyed calves that totter into streams, and a buoyant soul which might expand vastly if it were not constrained. I like this young and joyful voice upon me, smooth as milk. Come here, I call. Come here. Come closer.
Chapter 25
Pilloried,
repeats Mrs. Chapel, clinging to Mr. Trevithick's arm.
I cannot credit it. Sincerely, I cannot. What have I done to deserve this?
The constable shakes his head.
A very usual punishment, Bet?
Aye, for some. Lady so-and-so with her gambling den, she did not get the pillory. She is too good for it, and yet I am not.
Judges nowadays, no sense, Bet.
And younger than they used to be, did you mark that?
She shakes her head as they descend the steps of the court with agonizing slowness.
Why was the fine not enough for them?
They want to make an example of you. Keep the others in check. You must own that it is your turn. I've done what I can and rushed it through. If we go now, there will be no time for a crowd to gather. And then you're at liberty to go to your party. As if I shall still be inclined to.
At the foot of the stairs, Mrs. Chapel must pause to regain her breath.
A shame, she wheezes at length, to make such a spectacle of an old woman, to mock her.
She allows herself to be led to Mr. Trevithick's carriage, and expounds breathlessly as he and his men heave her in.
Oi!
is what crowds like, to pelt a poor, chained-up old woman with filth. What will my girls say? 'Twill break their hearts in two.
Now it may not be so bad,
says Trevithick, taking his seat beside her.
You don't know. You may have a kind crowd.
Mrs. Chapel curls her lip.
Not these days. They're a nasty mob, this generation. Look at America. We're all brutes deep down, they say. Well, some folk seem to have given up hiding it.
Do not fret. Go with dignity. Do your time. 'Twill all be over.
The carriage doors are closed and it moves off. It is not the smooth ride Mrs. Chapel is accustomed to. She wobbles on the seat and winces at her many pains. Her little hands scrabble at Mr. Trevithick's cuff.
I cannot do it, she whispers. I cannot stand all those hours locked up like they must have me.
And he nods sadly, knowing this to be the truth.
Well, you need not, he says. You may lie down for it. Can you manage that? To lie down for the 3 hours?
She expels a juddering lungful of air.
I'm loath to, but I can.
There's your spirit. There's your dignity.
Mrs. Chapel is to be pilloried at Charing Cross. As the carriage inches along the crush of Swallow Street, more passers-by turn to stare. And indeed, the traffic is so slow that one man, on foot, keeps alongside them for some time without breaking into a jog. He scowls through the window at Mrs. Chapel and mouths words that, to judge by his expression, are not complimentary.
We should have travelled more discreetly,
says the abbess.
This was bound to happen.
I had not thought anybody would know you, says Mr. Trevithick.
And he pulls the blind down.
If you know me, they know me, she snaps. Besides, any woman they see escorted to the pillory, they will draw their own conclusions. Hypocrites, she exclaims, who let their own daughters starve almost to death, or put them in cruel marriages, or slake their lust upon them most unnaturally. To think I do any worse by them. 'Tis an insult. The girls that come to me, and mark me, their own parents bring them often enough, suffer worse abuses in their own homes than they ever will with me.
No, but not all parents are bad parents. You must understand their outrage.
A muted thump without. Somebody has brought their fist upon the window, but provoked more by opportunity than strong principle. The groom calls,
Aye, no more of that. My horses will take fright.
There are apologies diminishing as the vehicle moves onward. Mrs. Chapel groans.
At moments such as this, I feel my years, she says. Had I the money, I'd retire tomorrow.
Mr. Trevithick laughs.
I think you've enough, dear lady.
Enough for today. One can never be certain of the future. And who have I to depend on but my own self?
The road widens and the carriage passes beneath the blind eyes of some dead king mounted forever on his horse. A great hammering on the body of the carriage makes them both leap from their skins.
Heavens! How dare they?
Mr. Trevithick raises the blind an inch, and having peeped out, immediately reels back.
What is it?
He mops his brow.
There are a great many of them out there, he says faintly.
The whisper has spread that a monstrous bawd has been apprehended. Aye, that squelch-gutted sow who in her youth turned the heads of half of London, and who in her vile dotage pimps the virginity of decent girls to fill her own coffers. Not only that, but this superannuated harridan, no good now for rutting or for childbearing, and thus superfluous to society, has the sympathetic ear of politicians, and even more sensitive parts of them besides, and an establishment where gadabout princes fritter away the allowances paid from the pocket of John Bull himself.
Well, what's to be done?
Nothing, madam, nothing. They will tire, I'm sure.
A disproportionate response, says Mrs. Chapel, as if there were a man among them who'd not paid for it once in his life, or a woman who's not taken money.
But a thundering breaks out on either side of the carriage, and all about it, and it shudders and rocks this way until it is fairly fit to overbalance. Men's hands slam against the window glass, and their voices are loud and harsh.
Bitch! Bitch! We know what you are!
Can we not drive on?
Mrs. Chapel has drawn her manacled hands up to her face, clinging at her shawl.
We're blocked in, he says. There's nowhere to go.
But because he is more heroic or less wise than he looks, he opens his door and leans forth.
Gentlemen, he cries. Gentlemen, please. I see that you are angry.
Give us the woman,
shouts one man.
Give us the board. She wants it into riots.
Now, gentlemen, do you see that she is being at this very moment brought to justice? Get back. Get back. Let us pass.
But a great howling and jeering and booing rises up. The men's faces are purple with rage, and they are men of every sort, not only toothless and scabbed beggars, but journeymen in decent clean shirts, and clerks and fathers with their children on their shoulders, shaking their fists and shrieking along.
No justice! A fine? A moment's glimpse on the pillory? What's that to her?
You protect her?
Who protects our daughters?
Please, I must assure you... Let's hear no more of this,
says a young man standing nearest, and he knocks Mr. Trevithick down into the dirt. Then all the mob crushes about the open door of the carriage, a hydra of snarling, spitting, yellow-teethed faces that burst in upon Mrs. Chapel, and their hands seize upon her. At first she does not move much, for her great weight keeps her pinned to the seat. Merely as they drag at her, her clothes are superficially rent.
Off!
She slaps at their hands.
Be gone!
But first, their force is such that she topples sideways onto the seat, and then it is a small matter of seizing at her wherever she can be seized, her elbow, her upper arm, in the finger-hold ribs of her stays, and although she struggles, she is hauled out into the street. She falls immediately to her knees, her hand palm down in the warm shit of some lately herded creature. Struggling to her feet, she cannot put weight on the swollen one. She grimaces, but does not make a sound. There are razor blades in her ankle, she feels, pins riven deep into the joint of her toe, and every part of her body has men's hands on it, who shove and drag and pinch.
To the pillory with this fat bitch,
somebody cries, and it is with their cruel assistance that she rises. She stumps and totters like a captured bear, swinging her head first this way, then that.
Move!
And somebody slaps her about the head.
Faster!
But her thighs obstruct one another. Her lungs burn. She cannot breathe. Somebody boxes her ears, and off comes her wig to the roar of the crowd. Her scalp gleams through meagre wisps of grey hair.
Have mercy,
she mumbles.
Have pity! I've done nothing!
But they are a great glee of noise. They pummel and shove her off the road and into the square. More and more are following now. Women, too, with their babies on their breasts, cheering and whooping.
We're taking her to the pillory! Come! Come see her punishment!
A rotten plum is flung. It bursts upon her temple into a tawny sludge, and its vinegared juice drips down into her eye. Somewhere, Far away, Mr. Trevithick is shouting,
"No! No! I demand you cease this at once!"
But it is to no avail. The first thing being flung signals for a veritable hail of objects. Apples clout her. An egg explodes into shards upon her shoulder. There are pebbles, and her blood is gummed upon her. A flower girl's rush basket pounds her temple. It smells of violets, but sends her staggering. She is afraid. She cannot control the momentum of her own feet. Her limbs, untrained in flight, are heavy and weak, and will not do as she bids them. All about her is a rage of laughter, and darkness intrudes on the corners of her vision. There are white sparks dancing before her eyes. Her chest is rent by sawing breaths, which seem to bring her no air at all. And her foot, oh, her foot, the fire in it is white hot, and it will find no purchase and support none of her weight. She stumbles, slips, is face down, eye to eye with the toes of many shoes. She has ceased to think, only to do. Her blood is composed of pure panic. But being old and fat and sick, she moves slowly like a snail when it is trapped by a child, which casts its head about stupidly to taste the air or see an escape, and rears its heavy body up. She rises from her knees, hands out, groping, but somebody kicks her in the flank, and she falls down again, slack cheek grating in the dirt. By some miracle of effort, she rises again, to her feet this time, and totters blindly through the crowd, as if there were any escape to be found.
"Look, fellas! Watch me!"
A boy of about 13 lifts his tricorn from his head and sprints towards her. The crowd parts about him. 2 yards away from where she staggers, he leaps gracefully into the air, hat held aloft, toes pointed. He comes down with all his weight upon her. His foot connects with her head, and she is down again, he leaping and tripping clear of her, all aburst with hilarity, and his friends running to join him with their mouths wide. She is moving yet, though all the intelligence be gone from her eyes. Her small hands with their tapered fingers fretting in the dirt, reaching and flexing as the hands of a newborn. This is when Mr. Trevithick's officers catch up with him. He has turned his back on the scene and is packing his pipe.
"Come on," he says. "That's the way. There is nothing to be done."
"Should we not intervene?"
"Are you mad, man? With only 3 of us? No, no, no. If we take her from them now, they will never forget it. Let them have her. Let them have her. They'll be quieter after this."
As they turn away, a second boy makes his run up and flies, both feet first, arms whirling behind him, to crunch into her ribs. How can it be that after each fresh blow she manages once again to rise? It must be by the energy of her will alone, for she has taken such a pummeling, and is so very old and weak, it cannot be her body that propels her. She utters not a sound. Her face shows no expression. She is a machine, it seems, set only on survival, so that each time she falls, she turns her face mutely again and again to the edge of the crowd and compels herself towards it, although her mouth hangs and there is a fluid dripping from her nose. The boys and men about her are equally determined that she will not get away. They jostle one another jocosely and laugh, but their eyes are very firm upon her, and whenever she looks to be making too rapid a progress, another of them launches from the group as arrow from bow to knock her down again. Each time she rises more slowly than the last. Each time takes fewer steps before subsiding to the ground once more. The last time she hauls herself to her knees. Something on the outskirts of the crowd seems to catch her eye, crusted as it is with blood and dirt. And she lifts one arm, through which exertion she trembles, as if it were made of stone, to stretch her fingers towards a flash of white. If anybody in the crowd had turned, they might have observed a dusky-skinned girl in a broad straw hat, holding her starched white gown, clear of the ground. Mrs. Chapel is alert to the last to a remarkable face or a fine form, but it is this girl's singular poise that now arrests her attention. She moves like a dancer or a duchess, her back quite straight, as if movement were for her a long-studied art or an expression of intellectual delicacy. At the edge of the square, she pauses, and seeing Mrs. Chapel collapse once more, presses her hand to her mouth. Then she bows her head and hurries onward, and does not look back. Mr. Trevithick and his men, now hastening down an alley, hear a roar from the crowd.
"Poor Bet," he says. "We'll not see her like again."
Chapter 26. The night before the party, Angelica wakes at some small hour. Something feels awry. She reaches across the bed, but Mr. Hancock is there at her side, snoring gently. She lies for some time, frowning up into the dark, as she listens to the noises of the night-time. An owl's hollow call, the rattle of tree branches, a clank, perhaps, of a carriage passing somewhere on the heath. Nothing that might cause alarm. She rolls onto her side, but cannot settle. She rises, at last, from her bed, and, not knowing why, crosses to the window and puts her head through the curtains where the glass is cool. At first, she sees nothing beyond. Even at this witching hour, the sky is not yet dark. It is almost midsummer, after all, and the place where the hill descends into the trees glows yet, whether with the vestiges of dusk or the first rays of dawn, it is hard to say. The clipped lawn is black and still. The white statues seem to waver upon it, their limbs not quite discernible, not positioned quite as she remembered. But this is a deceit on the part of her eyes. She blinks hard and peers again, although she shivers there on the wrong side of the curtain from bed and hearth. And now she sees it, one of those white figures, vague about its borders, striding across the grass. She swallows her own breath, trembling as she watches its fixed and purposeful progress through the wilderness and across the lawn to the folly. There it stops.
"Mr. Hancock," she whispers. "Mr. Hancock, wake up."
The white figure attempts the door, but it is locked. It rattles once again and utters a phantasmic moan. Then it paces the building's circumference as if it sought entry another way.
"Mr. Hancock!"
Angelica is loath to leave the window, but presently she feels him at her side.
"What is wrong?"
he asks, still blinking with sleep.
"Out there,"
she hisses.
"Look!"
He leans beside her, and together, their cheeks brushing one another, they stare out.
"Oh,"
he says,
"that is Suki."
And so it is. She wears her thin chemise and moves about the folly slowly and carefully, her hands trailing against the wall. She goes again to the door at the back, and they hear a great thud as she kicks the panels. She kicks again and again, and puts her shoulder to it.
"She will break it."
A thin cry of real grief rises to them on the wind as Suki pounds upon the door. The Hancocks do not hesitate. They hasten from the room and down the great stairs. Angelica slips on an unexpected step and almost wrenches her arm from its socket as she stumbles, clinging to the banister. But she barely feels it. She is up and running across the hall in her bare feet without a thought. The pair rattle at the French windows that lead from the dining room onto the stone steps to the lawn, and spill into the dark, calling out, "Suki!
Suki!"
At first they do not see her, and run down the lawn beside one another, an exertion neither is well prepared for, their lungs protesting mightily. Angelica's gown flies about her as she cries out, "Where are you, Suki? Go no closer!" While her husband stumbles ahead, wheezing to get a sight of her. He vanishes into the shadows at the back of the folly and cries out. There is crouched Suki Lippard, her chemise soaked in dew, keening with the truest grief. Her knuckles are skinned from pounding at the door, her bare feet bruised, their nails torn and bleeding where she has kicked and kicked for entry. Mr. Hancock lumbers to his knees beside her and draws her into his chest. She quivers with cold and with the sobs gathering still in her throat. Her skin is terribly cold. But when he seeks to lift her up, she shrieks,
"No! Do not take me away! No! No! I need to go in! I must go inside!"
He is not accustomed to lifting heavy burdens, and particularly not those that writhe and flail and claw at his face and kick his gut with bony feet when he attempts to hoist them over his shoulder. But he struggles back up the hill, nevertheless, grunting with the effort of it, until a vein throbs in his temple and his face is quite scarlet. Angelica runs alongside as Suki strains her arms towards the folly, howling as if she were being snatched from her own parent.
"Hush," she comforts her. "All will be well." "No, let me go back." "You will be better when we're away from it."
But Suki sets about weeping anew.
"I will never be better. The only peace I can find is there. Please, oh, please, let me go."
"Get her inside," says Angelica, and Mr. Hancock bears her up the steps and into the house. In her bedroom, with the candles lit, she is a dreadful sight, with her lips blue and her skin mottled grey. Her fingernails are quite purple with cold, more as if she had been half drowned by a North Sea squall than merely wandering abroad one dewy summer night. She is bruised all over, and streaked with her own blood. And even once Angelica has stripped her of her drenched gown and wrapped her in blankets, she slumps, shivering like a mouse released from a cat's jaws, her eyes quite glazed, her mouth slack. She is more than subdued. She is dejected. All the vivacity is drained from her. When Mr. Hancock tries to speak to her, or coax a little caudal between her lips, she turns her face away in perfect exhaustion and closes her eyes.
"Oh, God!"
Angelica hunches at her bedside, chafing her cold fingers in her hand.
"Oh, God! Did I do this?"
Mr. Hancock squeezes her shoulder.
"I did,"
he croaks.
"Oh, no! No! You only brought me what I asked for."
"I should never have brought it here."
"I should have proceeded differently when I discovered it. Oh, sir, do you think she will die of it? She's so awful still."
But the doctor, who comes just before dawn and takes her faint pulse and inspects her broken nails and bloodied knuckles, only raises an eyebrow.
"A nervous complaint," he pronounces tersely. "The night wandering, the rages, the lack of care for her own person. One sees it often enough in girls her age, although what they have to weigh so heavy on their minds, I'm sure I cannot guess."
"What can be done for her?" Angelica sniffs.
"I shall give her a draught to help her sleep. But you must train her better. It is evident she's been indulged. You're making a rod for your own back if you do not take her into hand. Strong passions are troublesome in a girl, but intolerable in a woman. Check her now, Mrs. Hancock, before she gains a reputation."
We shall do no such thing.
Angelica storms, and the doctor meets her husband's eye with pity as he departs. With Suki at last sleeping, Angelica folds her arms.
We must put an end to this, she says, immediately. Come with me.
They lay another blanket over Suki and take the precaution of locking her door before descending to the hall and through the servants' door to the back of the house, where hangs the row of leather fire buckets.
Fetch some down, says Angelica,
who is too short to reach them herself.
Quick, quick! I am meant to be your helpmate, not you mine.
Together they bear two buckets each out onto the lawn. The sky has taken on a greenish dawn tinge, fading into cobalt and bright white, and then the most blushing orange of a ripe apricot. Down the hill, the mist sits on the river. In the garden of their house, morning is flourishing. Daisies unclench before the sun, and bees hum amongst the overgrown roses.
A strange wedding gift you gave me, she muses as they reach the folly. A real creature, too sorrowful to display. A thing that tells us what we really want is out of reach. Give me your key.
What are you about?
He asks, looking askance at her. But he puts his buckets down and takes the key from his chain. The staircase descending is swept and newly mortared, fine and regular so as to trip nobody up. And down within, the vaults are musty no more but fragrant and scrubbed and camphor-smelling from the rugs laid on each brick floor. There have been many sconces fitted to the walls, and Angelica parades around, lighting the candles in each one.
You see, she says, as if there were need for a mermaid in this place. It would only distract.
She darts into the last room, lined with chairs. The vat, in the centre of the room where it was left, is large and ugly, soot-blackened, and, he sees now, much dented. Its canvas cover is lashed on with a rope that is unravelling back into flax. And Angelica wrenches it off at once.
What are you doing?
He demands, and now a sense of real panic seizes him.
I do not want this. I cannot bear this. To be content as best we can must be enough for us.
She fetches one of the elegant little chairs that line the walls, drags it to the vat, and scrambles up on it.
Look, she says, it will be easier than you think, for she is not a solid creature.
She plunges her arm into the vat and makes a fist. He thinks he will faint. She remains there for a moment, her eyes fixed intently upon his.
See? See?
And then brings out her empty hand, dripping. She swoops again, seizing at nothing.
I believe we can take her apart in buckets, as if it were only water we were moving.
Outside, the dawn chorus stirs and crescendos. Angelica climbs up to fill her buckets, and each one seems to her to let out a little, oh, an echo of water on metal.
Take these, she says.
He stands immobile.
No, no, I cannot. My mermaid, all I worked for. Our party, he protests.
Never mind that. This thing must go.
She hauls the buckets aloft, and drips hit the brick floor with soft little cracks. He steps forward, takes them from her.
Take them over there.
She points to the pool.
We are going to give this beast its freedom.
Is that what you want?
I want it gone away from my family.
She has a sibyllish look about her, her hair awry and her white shawl draped over her shoulder.
We have detained it too long. If it is angry, it is because of our ill treatment of it. What trapped creature does not strike out? Now here, help me.
Oh, The buckets drip as Mr. Hancock carries them, dizzy with fear, to the rock-lined edge of the pool. And, oh, they sigh as he empties them, two by two, whole buckets of sorrow, pouring into the dark water. He thinks he sees her there, in the well's queer phosphorescence. She dances like stars and then plunges downward. Far beneath the surface, she swings in netty lengths, rediscovering her atomized self. Then he goes back to switch his empty buckets for full ones. Standing by her chair, he reaches only Angelica's bosom. She stoops to kiss him.
You see? This is the right thing to do.
He goes back and forth more times than he cares to count, and his arms ache and his feet become chilled. His wife's lips are the only warm thing in the cavern, and he returns to them with each visit to the vat. Presently, Angelica finds she has emptied so much that she can no longer reach the surface of the water still contained within it. She is not afraid. "Nothing for it," she says, and hitching her wrap up above her knees, she climbs in. The water comes up to her shins, and is not as cold as she had expected. It is at least not the gripping cold she felt the night she swam around Mrs. Chapel's fountain. She crouches down to fill a bucket. The water swirls about her, almost loving, and she feels its soft sorrow tickle her skin as if a great many little fish nibbled her.
"Take care," says her husband.
"Oh, we're all right."
She crouches to stir the water again, the way children squat on the foreshore and study the drifting grains of sand.
"We're all right, are we not?"
she croons to the water where the mermaid was. Then she passes up a bucket.
"These are the last two," she says. "One for you and one for me."
He helps her scramble from the empty vat. Her wrap is wet and clings to her calves and thighs. Even her hair is wet and clings to her shoulders. She seizes it and twists it like a rope. Dropples fall to the floor, and she laughs.
"Are you ready?"
he asks, and she follows him to the pool, each leaning a little to accommodate the weight of their bucket. He realizes that he is tired. His bones drag as if they have been turned to stone. But this priestish moving of the water is nearly at an end. Even the vaulted cells of the grotto seem a little brighter than when the transportation began. Angelica draws close to his side as he empties his bucket into the pool with a swirl and a gulp. Then she steps forward herself, her pail raised above her head. With her hair loose and her white wrap clinging, she might be 14 years old and dancing as an acolyte of Venus once again. She balances the bucket on her shoulder, tips it gently, and pours it out in a long, unbroken stream, so that at the end the water closes in a perfect O, and one single drop leaps up into the air.
"And so it is done," she says.
"First I sink, then I trickle, then I rush. I am here and here and here. I touch this surface and also that. I mingle, I quiver with a thousand new voices, and all these voices my own. I am a great tumble of motion which torrents all in unison. And learning and knowing are the same, and I am a mite, and we are all the space allowed to us. And if I am made of grief, well, here is joy. And if I am made of fury, here is peace. Rush, rush, we rush, a sparkling stream through rock and moss, deep in the cold stone of the earth. No daylight here, no dying breaths to catch up. We rush young and bright and ever-widening, and these bitter atoms are lost in new minted freshness. We hasten, hasten, onward to the boundless sea. Epilogue. The Midsummer Party, the first held by Mr. and Mrs. Jonah Hancock of Blackheath, is an immense success. Mrs. Hancock is a hostess both affable and beautiful, resplendent in a mermaid blue satin gown which trails gauzy seafoam lace. Her marriage has been the subject of much gossip, but as she hangs on the arm of her bluff husband, her face bright with laughter, certain minds are changed. Their niece, Miss Lippard, is additionally much admired. Very properly, considering her age, she is permitted to appear on the garden steps for only a few minutes, a pale and elegant girl with a most arresting expression in her eye, who speaks not a word. She returns shortly to her own apartments, but on the strength of this brief sighting, several local mamas add her to their personal lists of girls with suitable qualities, and determine to monopolize her before she comes out. The house and gardens are declared faultless, and guests strolling the lawn praise its superlative aspect over Greenwich and the river. Then there is the delightful surprise of the grotto, its shells gleaming in the candlelight, and illuminations of ghastly sea creatures beyond imagining flickering over it to cries of delight and wonder. The guests are enraptured. They dance beneath the chandeliers. They trample crystal wine glasses into the brick floor of the vaults. They marvel at the scientific system of periscopes that lights up the peculiar green pool in the very furthest chamber. Most of all, they are impressed by its very particular atmosphere. For this underground wonder, as chilly as it may be, is all suffused with a character of its own, a quiet ebullience that must be thanks to the genius of their hostess. Or how could a small space have so much feeling to it? Friends embrace, strangers delight in new acquaintances, husbands draw their wives into dark corners. The food is light and delicate, the sort girls eat so that they might have the strength to dance all night. Syllabubs on cold slates, liqueur-flavoured jellies and strawberries and melons and millefeuille, and a great heaped centrepiece of butter-yellow pineapples, whose flesh, both fresh and roasted, perfumes the room and draws a crowd eccentric in its composition. Even its members are surprised by one another, having reasonably expected that a careful hostess takes pains to segregate her guests for the sake of delicacy. But they concede, without a word spoken, that this is really no different from any night at the pleasure gardens, where those of all walks of life are thrown together, and yet succeed in speaking to nobody outside their own sort. Besides, this is a mermaid party. A most amphibious thing. Who amongst them does not have the right to witness such a marvel? In fact, it might be observed that the grotto becomes a very menagerie, a wunderkammer of all the classifications of human, who pace warily together and watch with interest as each curiosity reveals its own habits as to feeding and dancing and drinking and conversation. Shipwrights hold forth beneath the gleaming white statues and fill their pockets with thin-sliced beef sandwiches. Greenwich's most rakish young couples are there, men and women equally adorned in flounced stocks and wafting ostrich feathers. Newly landed gentlemen, whose money comes from ships or coal or cloth, fall speechless in the presence of ladies whose faces once graced print shop windows. And a needle-slim governess of a woman leads six white-clad beauties soberly amongst the trees, their little plumed dogs trotting behind. Mrs. Hancock, low-born, the plaything of aristocracy and wife of a gentleman merchant, has run wantonly riot with her own address book and drawn all to her in the name of curiosity. There is even a rumour that the Countess of D herself has been there, aye, truly, in a gown much more voluminous than is her usual taste. So few attested to having seen her, and so briefly, that it can hardly be credited as fact. And yet, what other small dark lady can it have been who walked slowly with Mrs. Hancock down the lawn to the most secluded part of the garden, their arms around one another's waists, their heads nodding together in sincere and private conversation? Another visitor nobody sees at all. There is a young man in a deep blue lieutenant's jacket, a perfect homme comme il faut, who comes on foot across the heath with his hat in his hand, the better for the breeze to cool his black curls. Perhaps he hears the music, or sees the lights bobbing in the trees, but he stops at the top of the Hancock's drive and looks to where it curves towards the trees. He stands there for a long time, but ventures no further. And presently he replaces his hat on his head and turns away. But what of the promised mermaid? Well, there is the great joke. For nobody could forget that celebrated, hideous Hancock mermaid that so dominated the early part of the season. Who amongst them had not gathered about the crooked-limbed, sharp-toothed little form, or gazed upon its likeness in pamphlets and papers and posters? And who amongst them had not shuddered at it? Clever Mrs. Hancock knows that the beauty of truth has only a limited appeal, and that repulsion's special frisson is best left to the freak show. Instead, she has given her guests the mermaid that they most desire. It is there in the lustrous glim of her mussel-shell grotto, and the illuminations that writhe and flicker across its walls, in its dancing fish-tanks and fizzing wine, and the strange phosphorescent sparks that swirl in the green-lit pool. The vulgar quotidian is given no quarter here. All is beautiful and hazed as a dream. The shortest night of the year never passed more quickly. And that summer's morning, as the last carriage straggles away across the heath, Mr. and Mrs. Hancock lock the door of their grotto with a sigh.
"It could not have gone better," says Mr. Hancock.
"No, indeed."
Angelica's hair is awry and her face smudged.
"I can scarce believe that I managed such a thing."
"I can believe it,"
says her husband stoutly, closing his eyes to the milky morning breeze.
"You and I, together, we succeed at what we please. And yet," he frowns, "after I have spent a fortune getting mermaids, the people were most pleased by no mermaid at all."
"Ha!" She nudges him and takes his hand.
"They'd not have liked the real one much, would they? A grotto? A light show? Strings of pearls? If that don't amount to a true marvel, I do not know what does. We live in a modern age, sir. The things that are wrought may be quite as extraordinary as those that are found."
Mr. Hancock turns his face to the house, its stucco lit pink by the dawn.
"Are you ready for breakfast?"
he asks, and they walk hand in hand up the hill, the ghosts running happy about them.
The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock is published by Random House Audiobooks, a division of the Penguin Random House Group. Copyright, Imogen Hermes Gower, 2018. Copyright and recording, Random House Audiobooks. Imogen Hermes Gower has asserted her right under the Copyright Designs and Patents Act 1988 to be identified as the author of this work.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.